Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1341. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 15. It is being recorded on August 17th of the year 2024. Once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves my new co-host, Monty, and we're going to be showing how, as William Faulkner put it, the past has never been buried. It isn't even past, you know.
Absolutely.
When we were talking about Max Egan von Hohenlohe and Wynn Scott and Safindus and things going on in Spain and things going on in Latin America, there may have been X number of people who were, you know, rolling their eyes and saying, you know, who cares about that? And we've got Hohenlohe being fingered probably as the Nazi that Jim Garrison was focusing on, that by Lieutenant Colonel Ray Roca, who would know. And X number of people are thinking, well, you know, that's a long time ago. Who cares about that? Blah, 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 blah. And I think by way of addressing that, in my opinion, legitimate concern, I'm going to read an op-ed column from the Western print edition of the New York Times from August 7th of 2024. Now, I've got my mask on, Monty. Are my words relatively intelligible here through the mask and everything? Okay, very
absolutely
good. I may start foaming at the mouth after reading this op-ed piece. So, this is by Michelle Goldberg, and it really is vintage New York Times. The title, Vance, that refers to J.B. Vance, Trump's vice presidential nominee, candidate, I should say. Vance just endorsed a troubling authoritarian book. Now, authoritarian is one of the New York Times code words. It can mean ultimately fascist, or it can be any government the U.S. doesn't like. and that's the blanket term. I'm amazed because in the second paragraph of this column, Michelle Goldberg actually uses the word fascist, which is quite remarkable. Not only is it unusual for the New York Times to use that, but frankly, in my opinion anyway, the New York Times obscuring of the reality of so many events from the JFK assassination to the Vietnam War to all kinds of things has helped to bring us to where we have gotten to. However, I think this book will serve as, or this op-ed column about the book will serve as a wake-up call or a pail of cold water in the face, depending on one's metaphor of choice. Again, by Michelle Goldberg, Vance just endorsed a troubling authoritarian book. In the normal political environment, there would be little need to pay attention to a new book by the far-right provocateur Jack Posobiec, capital P-O-S-O-B-I-E-C, who is probably best known for promoting the conspiracy theory the Democrats ran a satanic child abuse ring beneath a popular Washington pizzeria. But Unhumans, an anti-democratic screed that Posobiec co-wrote with the professional ghostwriter Joshua Lysak, L-I-S-E-C, comes with endorsements from some of the most influential people in Republican politics, including, most significantly, the vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance. And Unhumans is the title that the author and ghostwriter apply to, quote, leftists, unquote. Now, who exactly that would be, I guess one could perhaps discern that Donald Trump has spoken repeatedly about wanting to take America back from the communists and socialists who run the Democratic Party, which is referring to Kamala Harris or Joe Biden or Anthony Blinken as communists or socialists is, I suppose it's original or creative, but accurate, not so much. But it uses the term unhumans to apply to those who are discerned as enemies. And, of course, the Nazis referred to their ethnic and racial opponents as subhumans. And I think that's worth keeping in mind here. Now, the second paragraph here of Ms. Goldberg's column, the word fascist gets thrown around a lot in politics, but it's hard to find a more apt one for On Humans, which came out last month. The book argues that leftists don't deserve the status of human beings, that they are, as the title says, unhumans, and that they are waging a shadow war against all that is good and decent, which will end in apocalyptic slaughter if they are not stopped. Quote, as they are opposed to humanity itself, they place themselves outside of the category completely in an entirely new misery-driven subdivision, the unhuman, unquote, write Posobiec and Lisek. As they tell it, modern progressivism is just the latest incarnation of an ancient evil dating back to the late Roman Republic and continuing through the French Revolution and communism to today. Often they write, quote, great men of means, unquote, are required to crush this scourge. Again, one more time. Often they write, quote, great men of means, unquote, are required to crush this scourge. That presumably means people of great wealth. And continuing here, the contempt for democracy in unhumans is not subtle. Quote, our study of history has brought us to this conclusion. Democracy has never worked to protect innocence from the unhumans, unquote, write Posobiec and Lisek. One of their book's heroes is the Spanish dictator Francisco Franco, who overthrew the second Spanish... One more time. One of the book's heroes is the Spanish dictator Francisco Franco, who overthrew the democratic Second Spanish Republic in the country's 1930s Civil War. The authors call him, quote, a great man of history, unquote, and compare him to George Washington. They quote him on what doesn't work against the unhuman threat, quote, we do not believe in government through the voting booth. The Spanish national will was never freely expressed through the ballot box. And that, again, a quote from Francisco Franco, continuing. Nakedly authoritarian ideas like this one are not uncommon in the bank corners of the reactionary internet or among the sort of groups that led the January 6th insurrection. On humans, lauds Augusto Pinochet, the leader of the Chilean military junta who led a coup against Salvador Allende's elected government in 1973, ushering in a reign of torture and repression that involved tossing political enemies from helicopters. Pinochet-inspired helicopter memes have been common in the MAGA movement for years. As the historian David Austin Waltz wrote last year, there's long been a cult of Franco on the right. Nevertheless, it is extremely unusual for a candidate for Vice President of the United States to openly align himself with autocratic terror. Vance provided the first blurb on the, quote, unhumans, unquote, book jacket. Again, quoting, in the past, communists marched in the street waving red flags. Today, they march through HR, human resources, college campuses, and courtrooms to wage warfare against good, honest people, he wrote. Jack Posobiec and Joshua Lisek reveal their plans and show us what to do to fight back, unquote. Other endorsements came from Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump Jr., a key figure in his father's presidential campaign. The foreword is by Stephen Bannon, Donald Trump's former chief strategist. Now, it is always possible that Vance recommended Unhumans without actually reading it, a practice that's not unheard of in book publishing. But unless and until he credibly distances himself from it, we should take him at his word that he shares the book's analysis. After all, some of the language in Unhumans resembles his own rhetoric. Quote, the great American counter-revolution to depose the cultural Marxists must occur on all terrains of society they currently possess, and on those they aim to seize, wrote Posobiec and Lisek, adding, quote, it is achievable, but only with the resolve of Francisco Franco and the thoroughness of Joseph McCarthy. They mean Joseph McCarthy, another of the book's icons. And Mrs. McCarthy, that's Senator Joe McCarthy of the McCarthy period. Compare that to what Vance said on the alt-right podcast Jack Murphy Live in 2021, when he argued that Republicans, upon taking power, should purge their opponents the way Iraq's government once purged members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. Quote, I tend to think that we should seize the institutions of the left and turn them against the left, unquote, said Vance. We need a de-Ba'athification program, but like a de-wokeification program in the United States, unquote. He argued that, again quoting, we don't have a real constitutional republic anymore, unquote, suggesting that Donald Trump need not be limited by norms of Republican governance. That's Republican with a small R. Trump said Vance should, quote, fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state, replace them with our people, unquote. And if the courts try to stand in his way, Trump should, quote, stand before the country like Andrew Jackson and say, quote, the Chief Justice has made his ruling. Now let him enforce it, unquote. You can and should laugh at Vance's melodramatic self-importance and creepy subcultural fixations. On Jack Murphy Live, Vance respectfully references Curtis Yarvin, a right-wing blogger popular in reactionary Silicon Valley circles, who calls for replacing democracy with a sort of technocracy. Excuse me. On Jack Murphy Live, Vance respectfully references Curtis Yarvin, a right-wing blogger popular in reactionary Silicon Valley circles, who calls for replacing democracy with a sort of techno-monarchy. It's good that Democrats have found in the epithet weird simple language to describe the 4chan side of the Republican Party. But in the Venn diagram between weird, unquote, and, quote, dangerous, unquote, there's a lot of overlap. Quote, much like the United States founding fathers, Francisco Franco and his fellows saw themselves as rebels intended to overthrow a corrupt, tyrannical government that aided and abetted murder and rape as well as other repugnant sins, unquote, write Posobiec and Lisek. We should take seriously the possibility, this is Michelle Goldberg commenting, we should take seriously the possibility that Vance and his fellows see themselves the same way. Well, given the history of the Republican Party, the Republican Ethnic Outreach Council and so forth, there's no reason to assume anything else. What struck me about that, Monty, is the resonance between so many of the overlapping topics that we covered in our first half dozen or so interviews. Prince Max Egan from Hohenlohe, his networking with Wynne Scott, who eventually becomes CIA station chief in Mexico City, the Falange, the history of the Falange, the affinity between the Latin American aristocracy and the Spanish aristocracy, and the operational links between Los Tecos and the Mexico City station and so many things. Plus, Monty, in some of our discussions, and we'll come back to him in a big way when we do our pivot to Asia, but General Charles Willoughby, who was MacArthur's chief of in military intelligence for years, and then became a luminary of the far right. When he formally retired from military service, he went to work as an advisor to Francisco Franco. And so much of the material, not just von Hohenlohe and Sophindus and all the feeding of the fascists in Normandy, fighting the troops who landed there, but the entire concatenation that we were talking about in the first half dozen shows, and so much of the work that is implicit in a wonderful, albeit a very editorially flawed book called Coup in Dallas by the late Hank Albarelli. Franco's Spain has been an epicenter of post-World War II fascism And it was an episode of pre-World War II and World War II fascism. And it also is not at all separate, obviously, from what we're seeing in the 2024 campaign. There's an old saying, Monty, in politics, follow the money. And in the context of Francisco Franco, the 2020 MAGA campaign, Augusto Pinochet, and so many of the things we've been talking about, you've come across some very, very interesting considerations. Fill us in on those, if you would.
Well, before we jump into that, I just wanted to give a little bit of you know, for your veteran listeners, this will just be like a rehash, as it were, but a little bit of the background of what exactly were the forces behind General Charles Willoughby when he was, in fact, acting as, of all things, an oil speculator for the Franco government in 1953 and 1954, and some of the elements that he was working with on a trans-Asian phalanx. And I realize that may be a little bit arduous to factor in, you know, that there are, in fact, Asiatic, Pacific, and Japanese intelligence, and of course mainland Chinese, of course, interests in Franco's holdings in North Africa, which is essentially what General Willoughby was representing. And I'd like to present a little bit of those backgrounds, personalities, before I jump into, you know, make the cosmic leap from that to what is going on in the 2020 election.
Oh, that sounds good. Now, when you say mainland Chinese, you mean nationalist Chinese / Kuomintang, right?
Correct. Okay. Not communist Chinese. Remember, the time period we're looking at here is 1950 to 1953. So I'd like to present just a little bit of that biosphere real quick.
So tell us all about Mrs. Willoughby's baby boy, Carl Adolf von Scheppel in Wiedenbach, a.k.a. Charles Willoughby.
Right. Well, if I may, as the commander of G2 intelligence, right before he retires in sometime in 1952 or 53, he completely retires from the United States Army. According to the research presented by Hank Avarelli and Peter Dale Scott, who's done some brilliant work over the years with the World Commerce Corporation, it appears that G2 intelligence, you know, bear in mind, Willoughby is the commander of that in the Pacific, help establish an entity called the Southeast Asian Supply Incorporated, or Sea Supply Incorporated. And its original comptroller in 1951 is a former OSS officer in Bangkok. I believe he was the chief of secret intelligence in Bangkok, and full credit for Peter Dale Scott in his book, The War Conspiracy. I believe it's chapter 4 that references DC Supply Corporation. A man by the name of Willis H. Byrd, last name B-I-R-D. And for all intents and practical purposes, the parent entity to Southeast Asia Supply Incorporated, which was established, I should note, for the edification of your listening audience, Sea Supply Corporation was established as a front to purchase armaments on an international scale, you know, essentially from any buyer on the planet, and then redistribute those arms to the Thai border police and in turn the Kuomintang. So essentially, Sea Supply Corporation, or Southeast Asian Supply Incorporated, was in fact a gargantuan gun-running network arming anti-communist and counter-terrorist border intelligence officials in Thailand. Now,
a question, Monday. Now, is that the same Sea Supply that was also established, was also affiliated with Paul Helliwell, or am I fusing a couple of synapses here?
Oh, no, that is correct, and I'll get to Helliwell in a minute.
Very good.
Ultimately, Sea Supply's parent entity was something called World Commerce Corporation. They had a headquarters in Bangkok under an entity called China International Commerce. So, you know, just to backpedal for a little bit, General Charles Willoughby is overseeing the creation of this entire armed supply phalanx in mainland China, which its chain of command at the lowest levels is Sea Supply under Willis Byrd. And then China International Commerce, which was run by another OSS official whose name is James Harrison Wilson Thompson. Once again, I'll repeat that name. James Harrison Wilson Thompson. And he had an interesting history, real quick, just to give a little bit of his background. Not only was he a CIA cutout, not a full-fledged CIA operative, but during the Second World War, he appeared to serve as the chief of OSS activities in Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka, during the Second World War, where he helped create and eventually became the commander of the pro-Allied Free Thai movement. All right. And as an editorial note, I should point out that he was also a member of the Jedburghs in North Africa, and he fought with the French resistance. Later on, as the commander of the Free Thai movement, he helped liberate Thai expats through the liberation of the Japanese army in what is now modern-day Sri Lanka. And he had the support of the Pridi Panamong, which was the regent king of Andran Mohodid of Thailand, all right? And he served as an unofficial Thai ambassador after the Second World War.
Now, just interrupt. How do you spell the Thai monarch's name, just for people who are taking notes?
This is Andre Mahodid, and this is A-N-A-N-D-A, first name, last name, M-A-H-I-D-O-L, who at the time was the regent of Thailand in exile, supported by the OSS.
Okay, thank you, Bondi.
And then ultimately, by 1946, we know very little about what's going on between the end of the war and the spring of 46, but eventually he becomes the military attaché to Thailand, and he establishes a front entity called the Crusade for a Free Laos, which is a full-fledged CIA operation. And he is funding these operations through a legitimate entity called the Thai Silk Company, LIT. And eventually he becomes known as the Thai, the Silk King of Thailand, controlling roughly over 64% of all of the silk products that are sold out of Thailand to foreign investors. So, I mean, it's a multi-million dollar corporation that he's running. Incidentally, as a member of the Women's Undergarment Union, which is fascinating because the president of the Women's Undergarment Union in 1953 was I. Irving Brown, who we know was a CIA counterintelligence operative working through the IFL-CIO.
Irving Brown was heavily involved with the narcotics maneuvering in southern France and Italy in order to requisition some of the organized crime drug trafficking syndicates as anti-communist cadre to break the labor unions in France and also Italy.
I am so glad you mentioned that, Dave. This is a brilliant segue. Because ultimately, James Harrison Wilson's Brown Crusade for a Free Thailand organization, according to all accounts, and once again, I'm quoting heavily from, of course, Hank Abarelli's Coup in Dallas, which gives some background about Sea Supply Corporation, which I believe is in Chapter 6 of that book, and then, of course, Chapter 4 of, I believe it's Chapter 4 of the Peter Dale Scott's The War Conspiracy. According to both of those accounts, the man that first tapped James Harrison Wilson Thompson to be president of World Commerce Corporation in Bangkok, and of course also a chairman of the board of China International Commerce, which of course was the parent entity to Sea Supply Corporation, was a United States Army captain by the name of Edwin Fahey Black, last name just like the color, B-L-A-C-K. It should be noted that by the 1970s, as a point of fact, by 1977, Captain Edwin F. Black was at that point in 1977 a major general in the United States Army, serving as secretary to the scientific advisor for policy of the Joint Research and Development Board of the Pentagon's Office of Special Defense. So by 1977, the man that tapped James Thompson to be president of World Commerce Corporation in Bangkok, under the command of General Willoughby, I might add, is Major General Edwin Black. And of course, Major General Edwin Black was the vice president of the Nugent Hand Bank in 1980.
Oh, boy. There is a career arc for you.
So ultimately, bear this in mind. James Thompson, the president of the World Commerce Corporation in Bangkok, overseeing China International Commerce and Sea Supply Corporation under Willis Byrd, both entities controlled nominally by General Willoughby's G2 teams in the Far East. Ultimately, it was a G2 captain, Edwin Black, that tapped Thompson to be president of World Commerce Corporation in 1950 and 51. The same general, later Major General Edwin Black, who would become vice president of the Nugent Hand Bank under Paul Leonel Edward Helliwell.
Nugent Hand Bank was a bank with branches all over Asia that was an intelligence bank laundering narcotics profits, among other things, and also funding covert operations, the best known of the latter of which was the overthrow of the Australian Labor government under Gough Whitlam. And there's good discussion of Nugent Hand Bank for people who might not be familiar with it. Many books talk about it. But AFA program number 25 goes into Nugent Hand at considerable length. Go ahead, Moppy.
Correct. So continuing on that, what is equally fascinating about you bringing up Paul Helliwell is, once again, it's a very convenient segue for me, because ultimately, and you know how I love to bring all this back to the Kennedy assassination, ultimately, the initial front CIA company that was created to support the Assault Brigade 2506, which of course was the 1500 man task force that was sent into Zapata Landing for the Bay of Pigs invasion, that of most of whom were captured by Castro's forces and interned, at least until President Kennedy brokered secret peace agreements in order to get them out of prison by the end of 1963. It's fascinating that the initial front company for Brigade 2506 was called the Gibraltar Steamship Company, all right? And the president of that was Thomas Dudley Cabot, who, of course, was a, I believe, older brother to Henry Cabot, or cousin to Henry Cabot Lodge, who was Richard Nixon's vice presidential candidate during the 1960 and 61 election cycle. And of course, Henry Cabot Lodge later became the ambassador at large to South Vietnam and oversaw the murder of the Diem brothers in 1963.
And by the way, we should mention, Moppy, the Cabots are a tremendously powerful American family. There's an old saying that in Boston, where the Lowells speak only to the Cabots, and the Cabots speak only to God. So they are among the Boston Brahmins and they're part of the American elite, the American oligarchs. So when we talk about Thomas Cabot or Henry Cabot Lodge, rather, and wasn't one of the lodges also connected to Ruth and Michael Payne? Am I fusing a synapse?
No, not at all. Ruth Payne's father, not only was he a cutout for CIA operations and I believe precursor OSS operations, but it is a fact that they were related by marriage. I believe Michael Payne and Ruth Payne were second cousins to Dudley Cabot Lodge and Henry Cabot Lodge. So, yeah, very close associates. By marriage.
All righty. Well, we had some technological burps there, but we are continuing. So, the Cabots, again, when you hear about Thomas Cabot being head of the Gibraltar Steamship Company, that not only is very relevant to the Bay of Pigs and to the Kennedy assassination, but to the American hierarchy itself, because the Cabots are extremely important.
Right. So, but ultimately, I wanted to pivot. Once again, this is going to pull back to General Willoughby, and ultimately, I will demonstrate the transatlantic Franco connection, and then I'll jump forward to the 2020 election, believe it or not. But I'd like to note, just as Willis Byrd and James Thompson were former OSS officers in Sri Lanka during the Second World War, it should be noted that in the published financial documents of the Gibraltar Steamship Company, which are in fact public, you can go onto the CIA's website and just type in Gibraltar Steamship Company Board of Directors, you will find a very interesting personality as one of the founding members and chairman and one of the co-chairmen of the board of the Gibraltar Steamship Company, which once again I should note was a front, one of the initial fronts for funding the Bay of Pigs invasion. We have a man by the name of Richard Samuel Greenlee, last name spelled G-R-E-E-N-L-E-E, Greenlee, Richard Samuel Greenlee. And according to OSS documents, and not only was Greenlee the, at the time in 1960 and 61, the vice president of the First National Bank of Miami, but during the Second World War, Richard Greenlee was the former OSS Chief of Special Operations and Covert Operations in Detachment 404, headquarters in Ceylon, Sri Lanka, all right, during the Second World War.
That was formerly, it used to be called Ceylon, and then when it became a separate independent nation, Sri Lanka. Go ahead, Marty.
So Ceylon, Ceylon, Sri Lanka. So ultimately, on the board of the, on the board of directors of Thomas Dudley Cabot's Gibraltar Steamship Company, we have another officer, another OSS officer, who not only was a commander, chief of all special operations and covert operations for Detachment 404 in the OSS, which means that he was in fact a direct subordinate of James Thompson and Willis Byrd during the Second World War. Byrd, of course, ran the Bangkok office. And then, of course, as I noted earlier, James Thompson ran the Sri Lankan office. But it is fascinating who Richard S. Greenlee's subordinate is. Now, once again, I am quoting directly from the official histories of the OSS, which, of course, is published by the CIA's website. They have a publication called Intelligence and Review. And this is Intelligence and Review. I believe this is issue number 66. And this is published in 1986. And it states the following about one of Richard Samuel Greenlee's subordinates in Detachment 404. It states the following. Greenlee oversaw the training and financial support for Kuomintang's Chief of Intelligence, Bureau of Investigation and Statistics, Lieutenant General Dai Lei. Last, full name spelled D-A-I, last name spelled L-I.
And by the way, you'll also see that spelled, the transliteration from Chinese is different, but Dai Lei, capital T-I, capital L-I. He was known as the Himmler of China. He was Chiang Kai-shek's security chief. And the fact that he was known as the Himmler, as in Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler, speaks volumes in and of itself. But one of the quirks, I mean, for the record, shows 1195 through 1214, I talked, actually, the 1195 through 1214, yes, I talked about Dai Lei. And one of the tricks that he developed was that he would get the inmates in his concentration camps, or Chiang Kai-shek's concentration camps, addicted to heroin, because the entire regime was founded on opium and morphine trafficking, heroin and morphine. So that's a good way of maintaining security at a prison. You get all the inmates hooked on dope, and they're not as nearly as likely to try and flee because they're going to need their fix. And so, yeah, Dai Lei was an extraordinarily bloody, murderous individual, again, known as the Himmler of China. That's the individual that Mappy is talking about here. Go ahead, Mappy.
Yeah, ultimately, thank you, Dave. Ultimately, Dai Lei was purportedly murdered by his own OSS handlers because he was just too much of a wild card. He was considered a brutal fascist, a gangster, and ultimately one of his subordinates was a man by the name of Duyu Shang, last name spelled Y-U-E-S-H-E-N-G. And he ran it.
That's bigger too, right? Duyu Shang?
Correct. Duyu Shang, correct.
I would amend something ever so slightly, though. Rather than describing him as one of General Tai Li's subordinates, which may have been the official hierarchy as presented to the outside world, but Duyu Shang was essentially the most powerful man in Kuomintang China. He was even more powerful than Chiang Kai-shek. He ran the Green Gang, which dominated heroin and morphine trafficking in China, later in combination with the Japanese. But the Green Gang got control of the Wampo Military Academy, the equivalent of West Point in this country. And all of the high-ranking general staff officers who graduated from Wampo were simultaneously Kuomintang general staff officers and kingpins, organized crime kingpins of the Green Gang. So I would actually submit, and maybe this sounds nitpicking or irrelevant, I would actually submit that Tai Li was maybe the subordinate of Tu Yuesheng, as was Chiang Kai-shek.
Right. I mean, I've heard that entertained, but the only reason why I describe him as a structural subordinate is that ultimately the financial support network for General Tai Li's secret police was in fact run, as you pointed out, by the Green Gang's narcotics empire under Duyu Shang, and that was the Blue Shirt Society, which was a direct copy of Mussolini's Black Shirts and ultimately Ernst Röhm's Brown Shirt organizations. You know, the sort of rainbow coalition of fascists, as it were, you know?
Well, the various fascist groups, you've got the green shirts in Romania, you've got the gold shirts in Mexico, the silver shirts in the U.S., William W. Pelley's group, so different, but also the Irish, a powerful Irish fascist group was also called the blue shirts. So there are various shirt colors that were selected as uniform emblems by various fascist cadre.
Right. So, backpedaling a little bit, we have to appreciate that within this whole milieu, Richard Greenlee, as the commander of special operations in Sri Lanka during the Second World War, later a chief finance officer and sat on the board of directors of Gibraltar Steamship Company under Thomas Dudley Cabot, we have to appreciate that he is, in fact, the chief of G2 operations, read into that military intelligence army, read into that, again, a subordinate of General Willoughby in Sri Lanka during the Second World War, overseeing Tai Li's operations in this theater of combat. So, skipping forward a little bit, after World War II, it should also be noted that Richard Samuel Greenlee became a tax lawyer for a law firm called Donovan Leisure Newton and Irving. And by 1962, he had become secretary of a CIA front called Vanguard Services Corporation, which in fact was the financial conduit for not only the Gibraltar Steamship Company in 1962, but also an island called Swan Island, where the CIA's Radio Cuba Libre, or Radio Free Cuba, was being run. So let's backpedal a little bit. Ultimately, the propaganda arm of the anti-Castro stay-behind elements through Radio Cuba Libre at Radio Swan was wholly funded by an entity called Vanguard Service Corporation. And that company was overseen by Richard S. Greenlee, who, of course, was, once again, I will point out, the chief of special operations in Sri Lanka under Task Force 404, where he oversaw General Nihilate's covert operations in that theater of combat. So consider all this continuity under the specter of General Willoughby. Remember, this man was ultimately suffering under General Willoughby's command. Perhaps not so incidentally, Radio Swan's broadcasts were actually co-opted by an Office of Naval Intelligence official by the name of William Wayne Dalzell, where he ran his own Radio Cuba Libre pirate radio network through an offshore oil rig that was actually co-financed by Franco's government under an oil millionaire by the name of Clint Murchison, all right? Oh. And this offshore radio network was called Radio Nord. And the commander of Radio Nord was actually one of Jack Ruby's closest associates in Dallas, a man by the name of Gordon Barton McClendon. Now, this is getting a bit convoluted, but it should be noted that Gordon McClendon in 1943, all the way to the end of the war, was one of the top Japanese interpreters. And for those people that know a little bit about the history of propaganda in the Pacific, there was a propagandist by the name of Tokyo Rose. Perhaps, Dave, you can give a little synopsis on Tokyo Rose.
Well, she basically spoke very good English. I think she actually was either of American, mixed American and Nisei, you know, Japanese-American heritage. But in any event, she, whatever her background was, and I read an article about her some time ago, but I can't recall that much about it. But she became a propagandist for Imperial Japan,
right.
She would call, you know, she had a radio show and they'd play good music, and then she'd come in and say, you know, wouldn't it be a shame if, you know, this group really continued with their plans to invade so-and-so, because so many of them will be killed and that they won't return to their wives and girlfriends, etc. So she was not only a Japanese propagandist, but something of a psychological warfare entity, in that she played on the heartstrings of American and Allied soldiers in the Pacific, and basically tried to discourage them from fighting against the Japanese.
So, ultimately, the way I would quantify Gordon McClendon's career during the Second World War is that he was essentially the American version of Tokyo Rose. Gordon McClendon was an expert in Asiatic languages. I believe he could speak fluent Japanese. He could speak Mandarin and Cantonese, and he could also speak some dialects of Filipino native languages. I forget which exactly ones he could speak. But Gordon McClendon was, in fact, a member of General Willoughby's Japanese intelligence, I should say English-based Japanese-speaking intelligence officers in the Pacific Theater of Operations. So that has to be considered under the milieu of what William Wayne Dalzell is doing in Radio Cuba Libre, which, of course, as I pointed out, is a sub-entity of Radio Swan, run by the Gibraltar Steamship Corporation under the Vanguard Services Corporation of Richard S. Greenlee.
By the way, you mentioned the law firm of Donovan Leisure and forgot nothing. That is the law firm of William Donovan of OSS fame. Go ahead.
Correct. Yes. So during this entire time period, Richard S. Greenlee is in fact a tax lawyer for Donovan Leisure, Newman and Irving. So, Irvine, excuse me. So ultimately we have this phalanx of OSS cadre, serving under the G2 command of General Willoughby, making up the entire covert action and propaganda arm of the anti-Castro networks very early on. And we also have the presence of the Radio Nord pirate station, which was run, once again, out of an oil tanker that was wholly owned by the Franco government, leased by Clint Murchison to Gordon McClendon and William Dalzell for the Radio Cuba Libre broadcast. So there is the first phalanx of what General Willoughby may have been using Franco's oil concessions in North Africa for. We have a clear indication here, Dave, that General Willoughby may in fact be using these oil concessions as a cover for massive anti-communist covert actions in the Western Hemisphere. Not in North Africa, but in the Western Hemisphere. So
the petroleum business is inextricably linked with the intelligence community, and so many major petroleum undertakings also have served as intelligence conduits or entities as well. Very quickly, Clint Murchison was a very well-known reactionary ballast oil man with strong links to CIA, and both Pin Jones and also the late William F. Pepper discuss a meeting at Clint Murchison's home the night before JFK was assassinated. And among the attendees at that meeting were J. Edgar Hoover, Richard Nixon, John J. McCoy, and some other people as well. And I believe, according to Pepper, LBJ's mistress was present at that meeting as well. And LBJ, according to William F. Pepper, came out of the meeting and gave his mistress a hug and said, after tomorrow, meaning November 22nd, 1963, the Kennedys will never embarrass me again. And he said, that's not a threat, that's a promise. And so that is who Clint Murchison is. He also was very close to Mo Dalitz and some other major organized contractors. I think Frank Costello as well. And through them also...
Yep.
Yep, had his hooks into J. Edgar Hoover as well. And he was also a very good friend of J. Edgar Hoover. So Clint Murchison is a fascinating guy. He also, according to the head of the Minutemen, was the chief financier of the American Nazi Party under George Lincoln Rockwell, whose Arlington, Virginia name and address were in Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest. And Clint Murchison Jr., was the owner of the Dallas Cowboys for a while. America's,
right.
America's team, or so.
Right. So I realize I'm getting a little long-winded here, but I'm going to pull in this phalanx back to Willoughby and what he's doing, and what I believe he's doing with the Franco government in 1950, between 51 and 53. So ultimately...
Yeah, when I interrupt to flesh out some of these names and institutions, it's to give... the listening audience a more complete understanding of, here we go again, the milieu that you are delineating for, so that they can better understand how these operational links hook up. Go ahead, Monty.
Right. So, technically speaking, if I were to backpedal just a little bit, William Wayne Dalzell's Radio Cuba Libre is in fact being completely subsidized in support of anti-Castro elements in Cuba before the Bay of Pigs invasion through a series of front companies that are ultimately all linked back to James Thompson's World Commerce Corporation branch in Bangkok, which of course was an entity of General Charles Willoughby's G2 networks in the Pacific. Of course, it should not be downplayed that Colonel Paul Leon Edward Helliwell, who was Willis H. Byrd's partner in administrating Southeast Asia Supply, a.k.a. C Supply, in their day-to-day activities, he was also running a series of CIA-connected money laundering schemes connected to the anti-Castro operations. There was something called Red Sunset Enterprises, which actually was a front to pay out the deaths of pilots and navigators that were flying B-26 invaders during the Bay of Pigs invasion. For those listeners that don't know, I'm sure veteran listeners will be knowledgeable of this, but there was in fact a flight of Alabama Air National Guardsmen during the Bay of Pigs invasion. I believe it was an entire squadron of A-26 invader fighter planes, attack bombers, that most of them were shot down by Castro's forces simply because the A-26 is a piston aircraft, and Castro's Air Force had T-55 jet fighters. You know, so ultimately, it was a lopsided engagement.
The B-26 was a medium bomber of World War II. I think it was actually called the Marauder.
And the Marauder, excuse me. Yeah,
yeah, there was I've forgotten what it was. It was one, a carrier-borne fighter was called the Invader, but it was not the B-26. But yes, and one of the fellows...
A-26, correction, A-26.
Okay. one of the fellows who trained the Bay of Pigs pilots was Arthur Haynes Sr., who was the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama, when Bull Connor was doing his thing, suppressing the civil rights workers there. And Arthur Haynes Sr. was also the attorney for Robert Chambliss and other people eventually convicted in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, which is linked through the tapes of Joseph Adams Mill Peter to the assassination of JFK and Martin Luther King. So, yep, once again, that's who we're talking about here.
Right. It should also be noted that Bull Connor worked extensively with the Louisiana State Police Anti-Communist Task Force, or the Red Division. And the commander of that was actually William Guy Bannister's older brother, James Bannister. So let that sink in for a minute. Yeah? those connections.
That really is interesting. And Bull Connor, of course, was the sheriff of Birmingham, Alabama. That is not in Louisiana, but obviously these people all networked together.
Right. This was their red networks, you know, that they were working with the Un-American Activities Committee in that time period. Yeah.
Fascinating. And, bearing in mind as we traverse all of the things that you're unpacking, Mobby, Officer Glenn Pinchback's statement to Jim Garrison after investigating some of the Nazis at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, that Garrison was also looking into. And he said he came across, quote, a Nazi plot gargantuan in scope to enslave America in the name of anti-communism. And, you know, looking back at the Jack Posobiec book, you know, when there are no communists, you have to invent them. And if that means labeling Kamala Harris and Joe Biden and Anthony Blinken and the Democratic Party as communists, well, that's again, if nothing else, that is creative. But it also would fit in, you know, the talk of cultural Marxists, and I'm not sure quite what those are. But again, enslaving America in the name of anti-communism. So go ahead, Marty.
Right. So ultimately, all roads in the anti-Castor effort lead back to World Commerce Corporation Bangkok, which ultimately, once again, was at least in part, created and functioned to support anti-communist death squads, primarily in Thailand and in South Vietnam, which in fact were extensions of General Charles Willoughby's G2 networks at the end of the Second World War. And this is so important for your listeners to understand, and I'm sure once again veteran listeners will appreciate this. Willoughby oversaw all military intelligence activities in the Pacific during the Second World War, including mainland China and the infamous China-Burma-India hump operations. Bear in mind, there was no air force in the Second World War. All air operations under the United States Army Air Forces were run by United States Army Command, meaning that General Willoughby was also chief of all air intelligence operations in this time period.
Do you know what, Martin, when did Willoughby resign? Because he also was chief of G2 during the Korean War, or at least much of it.
General Willoughby officially goes in on the retirement list for the United States Army in July of 1952.
Okay, so most of the Korean War, he's still G2.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
An incredibly important guy. I don't think one, the more time passes, the more significant he becomes in terms of unraveling and understanding our clandestine history. A very, very important individual, and not just for Asia, but for Europe, for Spain, for the U.S., for Latin America. And I suspect that in our next talk, you'll be further fleshing out just how important he was for us. We've got about 5 minutes left here, Monty.
Right. Well, ultimately, before we end this program, I wanted to mention the chief editor of the War Department during the Second World War's Military Intelligence Division. So read into that. The man I'm about to mention actually published and edited the vast bulk of the intelligence reports that were coming out of forward operations for commandos under General Willoughby's command. This was a captain in the United States Army by the name of John Garrett Underhill Jr. Last name spelled Underhill. Underhill. John Garrett Underhill. He was also known by a nickname, Gary Underhill or Jerry Underhill.
Okay. I was just going to say, is that any relation to Gary Underhill? But it's a very, very close relation indeed. The same guy. Continue, Monty.
Right. By 1963, John Garrett Underhill literally went from being the chief editor for G2 operations for the entirety of the War Department's Military Intelligence Division. Read into that. He was editing intelligence reports for General Willoughby. But he later became a chief small arms weapons expert. In fact, and there are CIA reports that indicate that he was at one point the CIA's top small arms hand-to-hand combat expert in 1952. And later, by 1963, he was the military affairs advisor to Time Life to the Pentagon. You know, so read into that. You know, Underhill was a direct liaison between Henry Luce's Time Life empire and the Pentagon, okay? And this is something that he stated, according to CIA documents pertaining to Jim Garrison's investigation into the murder of President Kennedy. This is a direct quote from Underhill from a CIA document, which I will include a link to in the annotated notes once I get to the notes of a couple of other programs. Quote, the friends whom Underhill visited say that he was sober but badly shook. They say he attributed the Kennedy murder to a CIA clique, which was carrying on a lucrative racket in gun running, narcotics, and other contraband, and manipulating political intrigue to serve its own ends. Although his friends had always known Underhill to be perfectly rational and objective, they first did not take his account seriously. To think the main reason was, as explained Underhill, that we couldn't believe, right? Reading again, this is the husband of one of Underhill's friends. We couldn't believe that the CIA could contain an element every bit as corrupt and as ruthless, and be it more effective, as the mafia. End quote. So I'll read again what Gary Underhill told his friends right before he purportedly committed suicide in 1964. May of 1964, Gary Underhill shot himself twice at the back of the head using his left hand, even though he was right-handed. Gary Underhill stated the following to his wife and his friends. He attributed the murder of President Kennedy to a CIA clique which was carrying on a lucrative racket and gun running, narcotics, and other contraband, and and manipulating political intrigue to serve its own ends. Sure as hell sounds like the network I just described under General Willoughby, now doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, you mentioned Peter Dale Scott, we've got about a minute and a half here. So again, Gary Underhill cited a network which sounds very much like what you have been unpacking for us here, Monty, as being behind the Kennedy assassination, and then he was found dead on alleged suicide after shooting himself twice in the back of the head with his left hand, despite the fact that he was right-handed. Another one of those funky CIA-connected suicides. And we will continue with this in our next discussion, but we are all out of time. An apology to the listening audience for the technical difficulties, but we've just been led some power weirdness. So anyway, this concludes For the Record program number 1341, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 15. This is being recorded on August 17th of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.